Hello, hello everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Palace Way podcast. And what a weekend to be recording it on. Palace coming off the back of a resounding win over Liverpool at Anfield, something we don't really get to say very often as a fan base. And joining me to unpack all things Palace, our returning guest, Mr. Tampa Palace himself. Pat, how are you doing?
Hey, what's going on? Glad to be back, especially after a wonderful performance on the weekend from our boys.
I feel bad because in the interest of time, and we'll get onto that in just a moment, we have to kind of gloss over the City result a bit, which is something I'm not a fan of doing. But there is some general points we'll have to make here about how the clubs have really progressed under Glasner. And we'll definitely look at some of those metrics that you've been unpacking on Twitter, because I think a lot of fans were really sort of warming to what you were posting about. So that's definitely not the most exciting thing, I think. You know, we're obviously going to have to get a bit romantic about what was an absolutely stellar performance, one I think that was incredibly complete from a team standpoint, and one that will live in the memory of fans for many years to come. But before we jump into that, just tell our listeners a bit about where you are right now.
I am in the middle of a very hot Jeep Cherokee, recording in my school's parking lot. I run a PE department at a charter school here in sunny Florida, and I figured I could sneak away for a free period to talk about the thing I love most, my beloved Crystal Palace, and wanted to take away the risk of having screaming school children in the background. So I'm on a hotspot on my phone, connected to my laptop, ready to talk. Let's do it.
Absolutely. I mean, that is probably one of the most bizarre tech setups we've ever had on this pod. But, you know, even the weather where you are, it's like proper sunny. It's true Florida here. It's absolutely pissing it down in Manchester. It feels very, very fitting. And you know what? I couldn't be in a better mood. Palace are absolutely on it. Talk about that result, right? I mean, it was just phenomenal start to finish, whether it's, you know, going attacking on the counter, whether it's from a defensive standpoint. I mean, we could just. Where to even begin? But I think we'll have to kind of just take it back a bit. And as I mentioned just now, obviously, I want to talk a bit about the underlying performance metrics that you've been looking at. And just for a simpleton like me, you were talking a lot about, you know, non-penalty XG per 90 and how it kind of compares under Roy versus Glasner, how it compares in relation to different opponents. Could you just kind of dumb it down, explain what it is, and explain how it's changed so quickly under Glasner, just before we look at the Liverpool game itself?
Right. So non-penalty XG is we're looking at expected goals, which is really the quality of shots you are taking, right? To give an example of it, a penalty is about 0.8, between 0.75 and 0.8, depending on which company you're using. So essentially what they're saying is a penalty is going to go in about 80% of the time. So non-penalty XG is open field, taking away penalties, because we know penalties aren't really indicative of how we're playing. It's just kind of, situational. So we take that away, we take away that variable, and we're just looking at the quality of chances that we're getting. How good are the shots that we're taking? I got the numbers right in front of me. So under Roy, we were averaging right over one MPXG per game. So 1.06, if we really want to crunch the numbers. That's gone up by one third. It's gone up 33% to nearly 1.5, right around 1.4 and change. And also in terms of defending, now, we're at about the same. We're at 1.3. We're at about 1.36, 1.37 right now with Glasner. And again, just to be clear, this is for like opponents. So I'm looking at Liverpool, City, Bournemouth, Forest, Luton, Spurs, and Burnley under Roy and under Glasner. Obviously, that's not perfect. There's different things. Teams have transfers, teams have injuries. We know that. But this is the most fair that we can try and make it. So we're not comparing, us playing a great team versus Roy playing a terrible team or vice versa. So our MPXG, our chances created, has gone up. Our MPXG allowed has slightly increased, but really it's negligible. And then that wonderful, most important thing, that expected goal difference, where we're taking the chances created versus chances conceded, that has gone up considerably from negative 0.3 to right around 0.1. So that's a huge difference. And you're obviously seeing that with the performances in the matches now.
Phenomenal. I mean, it's really transformative. And as you say, with a bit of a skeleton crew as well, accounting for injuries. And speaking of skeleton crew, I mean, again, I feel bad for glossing over City, but we have to talk about the lineup going into that Liverpool game. I mean, it's not something we want to do too much, as I say on this pod, in terms of looking at things too granularly from a kind of play-by-play standpoint, from a tactical standpoint or a personnel standpoint. But We rocked up to Anfield and kept a clean sheet with one fit centre half in that 11. We had Jefferson Lerma, who's very, very new to this kind of left centre half role, as well as Nathaniel Clyne, who's certainly not tall or physical and, really put in a very deceptively strong shift, I think, there on the right side. I mean, defensively, it was a masterclass, but I mean, just talk more generally within that game about some of the defending, because there were so many flashpoints throughout. And I think it's something that we have to kind of pick out before we even look at the goal, before we even look at some of the fluid attacking play, because I mean, it was not one for the faint-hearted, that I'll say that.
No, you're absolutely right. And just shameless plug, I did put a match report up a few hours ago if you want to go to the page. That's CPFC underscore Tampa and look into it. I gave some more details of it. But to talk about the two players that you mentioned, first of all, Jefferson Lerma, if you told me that he has been an outside central defender in a back three for his entire career, I would wholly believe you without a shadow of the doubt. He's been phenomenal there. And I've touched base on this a little bit online with some people. For a club like us, where we're not going to have the funds that the top six are going to have, we're not going to have the depth that the bigger clubs are going to have, having somebody that's able to fill in at multiple positions, in the back line, in the central midfield, like Lerma, is so inherently valuable because we're not going to have the money to go buy two players that can do that. So having one guy that can not only fill in admirably, but fill in very well is huge. And then on Klein, I mean, he did great, and we did some tweaks to it. If you look at the average positioning of our guys, Munoz stayed much deeper than he ever has since his time starting at Palace. He played farther deep. Mitchell was actually the one that was playing far more advanced out of our wing backs, and that was obviously, in my opinion, I don't know if it's obvious, but to me, just looking at the numbers and kind of being able to form opinions on it. I think that was done on purpose to try and protect Klein. And we knew that we were going to see some things with Klein back there. Like you said, he's not the tallest guy. He's never been one to jump super high in the air. We did lose a lot of aerial duels, but we actually won more ground duels. We won more than half our ground duels. So we won the ground duel battle. We were winning those 50-50 balls on the ground, which against a squad like Liverpool, who prides themselves on doing that kind of dirty work, that shouldn't be simply just swept under the rug. That should be talked about and lauded. So for all the risks that we had with Klein, it seemed like Glasner was aware of it, and he put our guys in positions to protect his weaknesses and highlighted his strengths by trying to use that pace to try and defend against Diaz and Gakpo and whoever else was down that left flank.
Yeah, I know, it was phenomenal. I think there were so many good individual performances. I think we could spend all day lauding individual performances going through the stats. But one player I really want to highlight as well is actually Anderson himself, because he's someone that's come under a lot of criticism this season. He's had a few flashpoints, particularly under Roy, where he wasn't in the sort of supporting sort of back three role, and he's really struggled at times. But I think we've had a real sort of zero to hero moment for him, because he really, really shepherded that line fantastically. Took the captain's armband, and I feel like his mentality just shone through. He was very communicative. You could see that throughout the game. But he made 14 clearances and 9 accurate long passes as well, and just a testament to his ability at both ends of the pitch. He really played a crucial role in build up. He was really at the heart of everything that went well in that game, and won a very tight man of the match vote in the post-match poll as well. I think it was a fantastic display from him as well. But as you say, I think to come up with a makeshift back three like that, to really keep the faith in the system that's being built, and to come away with a performance that strong, is a real testament to the spirit of this team. Dean Henderson had some very interesting post-match quotes actually about the mentality, and Glasner was genuinely quite keen to suggest to the squad that they can win this. This sort of, backs against the wall underdog mentality suited Palace fantastically, coming away eventually with, like I say, a historical win, the first at Anfield since October 22 in the Premier League. Coincidentally, Liverpool not having the best of weeks, are they? But that's not the point. You can tell I'm almost excited just talking about it, and I think I kind of share this kind of euphoria that we were having as a bit of a fan base at the moment. But we do have to put our feet on the ground and to try and do some justice to real analysis here. So, I want to talk about the goal itself. I think we have to kind of shine a spotlight on that. It came from some sort of prime Barcelona-esque style passing football, didn't it? I mean, talk me through that. I mean, there were so many touches involved, so many players. I mentioned Anderson, he was part of that build-up, but you could look throughout the squad to really see where that goal came from.
Yeah, I mean, I went back and counted it because, of course, I did. It's me.
Of course.
17 passes, 17 passes. Unreal. And to your point on Anderson, because, this bridges the gap between the two things we're talking about, having him be in that middle of the back three, it almost highlights everything that he is strong with and eliminates his weaknesses because Now he has two extra defenders to protect him instead of being in a pairing because, sometimes he's a little lax defensively. It happens. So we have an extra defender back there to kind of protect that. And it allows him, when we do have possession, to step a little bit forward into the midfield where he almost plays as the base of a midfield trio, if you will, between Hughes and Wharton in this scenario. Now he's not going super high up, but if you go back and watch the match, you'll see him drifting forward into midfield a little bit. And he gets to play that, Regista role, that deep lying playmaker where he is able to use that amazing array of passes that he can have. He can spray that ball left, right, and center and diagonal all around. And we can do that without having to fear him being caught out in a counterattack because we have some other defenders back there. So having him there really helps springboard our attack in that first phase of build. And then what more can you say about the goal? I didn't think I'd see a better goal at Anfield by Crystal Palace than the one Andros Townsend scored a few years back, but here we are talking about it a few years later, and I think I've seen one that tops it.
Absolutely. I mean, I did hear Regista and instantly thought of Football Manager. I think you just stopped playing it. But that aside, very, very good point. Yeah, it was fantastic as far as team goals go. I think to really overload on the left like that was phenomenal to see. And I think it was a really good use of basically exploiting Liverpool's weaknesses, who I felt, really took the bait from a positional standpoint. They simply didn't really track their man and they sort of got panicked and kind of lost their relationship to one another. It was really, really interesting to the point where you can even see Jurgen Klopp mouthing, "Wow, having seen such an astounding team goal." I thought that was a real sort of cherry on the top moment. Really, really calm finish from Eze, by the way. I can't lie, I couldn't make the game at the time. I was out with friends, and when I saw the notification come up, I just couldn't quite believe it. It seemed a bit surreal to go up at Anfield like that. And then when I actually did bounce to get to the pub and watch it, I mean, it was phenomenal. Now, I know that's a bit of an armchair fan thing to admit, but we'll move on. One player that really stood out was Adam Wharton, and I kind of want to give a shout out to Will Hughes as well, because again, another maligned figure who I think really stepped up in that game. You don't put in a performance individually that's that bad and come away, with anything. If you have a bad day, you have to be on it. And I think every single player did their part phenomenally. So talk to me about that double pivot, because I think there's so much to be said there for Wharton and Hughes. What really stood out for you about them?
First, I want to give just a real quick touch on Eze, just to point, and then I'll go into our midfield. Just to your point of how calm he always is. I don't know if it was the same broadcast over the pond there, but on the American side, they had a pre-match little quick interview with him where he just was very cool and collected and talked about how, the manager set us up with what we know what we have to do. We're going to go in there and try and get the 3 points to the point where the person interviewing him looked at him and said, "You seem very calm," and Ez's response was always, and gave us a little smile that we so know him for. So before the match, he was just already in his element. He just so the level of composure when he's having fun, he's just an absolute joy to watch. But to go back to that pivot you talked about, one thing I really like about Glasner is he's not trying to fit any square pegs into round holes. He seems to understand how players work and isn't asking too much of them beyond their skill set. And I think the great example of that is Will Hughes. Will Hughes hasn't really been asked to do a lot of creative build-up play. He's not been asked to make a lot of off-ball runs, far post, near post, anything like that. His job has really been to just go and be a destroyer. And if you watched how he played out of possession, he was a madman in the best way possible. Every time the Liverpool would try and build through the middle, the second that their midfield would go to turn on the ball, he would be right there waiting for him. They did not give him anybody a second, an ounce of time on the ball to work through that build. And that's why they were trying to spray it wide the entire match and try and utilize Salah and utilize the left flank a lot, which is coming into common territory with us trying to pick on that right center back spot. But I believe that Hughes is just being asked to do the things that he can do well and no more than that. And that's why he's having these great performances. As far as Wharton, we all had an idea this kid was going to be good, but we all kind of thought he was going to be good next season. This first 6 months was going to be
Very
a
much
kind of
so.
chance to
Yeah.
acclimate himself to the Premier League, to the rigors, to the physicality, to the speed of the game. And good Lord, I mean, I'm so impressed by the way that he's been playing. His heat map from last game out of possession stretches from the edge, the left side edge of the 18 yard box to the right side edge, and basically from the box all the way up to the center circle. I mean, he was all over the place. When Munoz or Mitchell tried to make a run forward, he would be the one to track back into the pocket and cover that counterattack. If Anderson stepped into the midfield a little, he would almost track back and try and protect there. He was great on the ball as well. I mean, he was making these wonderful passes. I believe he was the one that had the diagonal down the left flank to Mitchell to set up like the hockey assist, so we say, the ball before the ball on Eze's goal. So not just the stuff out of possession, but also the stuff in possession. I think he just has these amazing instincts, amazing way to be able to maneuver and turn his body to shield himself. And I think as he gets stronger and puts on some size and some physicality, he's just going to get better and better.
Not to go all Bramante, but Wharton has this poetic like grace on the ball. It's my favorite trait about him, of which there are many I could point out, but his ability to just control tempo by himself is I haven't seen anything like it in a long time, let alone from a deep midfield role for someone who's so young. It's just, one of my most pie-faced predictions was that I thought, Wharton would be a good player, but I thought we probably paid a bit too much for someone with very little experience. And like you say, he would take a while to mature. It wouldn't really feel like good value for money, like maybe we're saying for França, who again could be very good one day. With Wharton, it's like, no, we've paid a very sizable fund, like sum for a championship player, but he's come in and just absolutely ran the show. And if we'd had him for the rest of the season, I mean, it would have been even crazier to think where we could be now.
And
That's a yeah.
let's be honest. Anyone that says they expected this level of play from him is lying through their teeth.
Yeah.
Nobody, not a single person. That's not to say people didn't have high hopes for him. I certainly did. But like I said, I envisioned this as kind of like a 6 month trial period for him to be shown the ropes and learn. I mean, he's blown all of our expectations out of the water. I couldn't be happier with a signing than him.
Not that I'm in any rush to lose him, but he feels like the next £80 million player alongside maybe Elise on that conveyor belt. Really, really interesting to see how his career goes. But, for now and for the far future, he's a Palace player. That's what matters. And, really, really excited for him. Really, really got attention as well. And I feel like it's these games that define careers in some ways, where you put yourself on the radar like that. So I'll put the speculation aside. Wing backs. Let's talk wing backs. We know Glasner likes them. I feel like we've kind of instinctively just gone down the pitch and looked at all our key players and their flashpoints. But the wing backs obviously were vital in that game. I think Tyrone Mitchell, again, someone who gets a lot of scrutiny, but actually held up pretty well and ended up having probably one of the best games of his career. It's no easy feat to keep a clean sheet at Anfield, let alone to keep Mo Salah quiet, and he did that phenomenally. So let's put Munoz aside for one moment. Talk to me about Mitchell specifically, because I think he's a lot more interesting in that game. I mean, how did you find Mitchell's overall performance, and do you think we can expect more of the same from him?
I hope so. He was asked to play in the most attacking advanced role that he's been put in, at least under his time with Glasner. Maybe you can go back to some times with Vieira that he was asked a little more attacking, but I would say probably not even there. And he absolutely rose to the occasion. He was, I think he completed 2 out of 3 dribbles. He of course had the assist on a just incredible cutback to Eze. I mean, Eze didn't have to do much. Like we talked about XG and all that. I think Eze's XG on that shot was 0.55, which is slightly less than the probability of a penalty going in. So that goes to show you how good of a ball he was and how good of a position he was in. And yeah, I mean, we can talk about the attacking side of things, all he did. Palace attacked 59% of the time down their left flank. That is the highest number that I have ever seen between the left, the right, or the middle of attack. And all the time that I've been doing stuff like this, I've never seen a number at 59%. So everything went through Eze and everything went through Mitchell, and he only got dispossessed 2 or 3 times. So he wasn't giving the ball away. He was constantly in good positions. He was making the right pass. And that's just talking about the attacking phase. He also had one of the best players in the world. You know, he's maybe getting a little older now, but Mohamed Salah is still absolutely world class. And between him and Lerma, Salah didn't do much. He had a couple chances at the end when we were getting on tired legs and we had some subs in. We can talk about all that stuff a little bit later. But all in all, he had a stellar defensive performance against Salah, stellar defensive performance against anyone else that drifted onto that left side. And not only that, but he was able to move forward and contribute for our only goal. So for someone that has been seen as a defensive specialist and maybe kind of a sore thumb in terms of being an attacking wingback, he's proven a lot of people wrong with that performance, and we can hope that there's more to come.
Absolutely. I mean, like it or not, we're going to be reliant on Mitchell for the foreseeable future. And I, for one, have been one of his biggest fans. I think he gets far too much criticism because he's unchallenged in many ways. I thought, again, another phenomenal performance. And, you can't help but think he should be looking on the England squad, to be honest. With Luke Shaw and Chilwell out of form, injured, and so on, you have to think he's got to be in it with a shout. But, stranger things have happened in football. It could well be on the cards still. And if he puts in performances like that, I think it should be much more of a conversation that we're having on this pod. Again, I feel like we've kind of accidentally stepped into doing a kind of player analysis, which wasn't my plan, I must admit. It wasn't in my notes, but I really like it because I feel like it's encapsulating a lot of the key flashpoints and the sort of debates that we always seem to have as well in many ways. So I think we'll look at both ends of the pitch. And before we get on to Henderson, who I think really stole the show in many ways, I think we need to talk about Mateta, who, again, has been in a terrific vein of confidence and form. Very unfortunate not to continue his scoring run. I mean, he's probably put Van Dijk on his arse, let's be honest. I think everyone was very aware of that moment when he causes Van Dijk to slip in a very, feels like a very kind of memorable moment for Liverpool fans. Probably a sort of reflex I don't want to really get used to. But yeah, their captain slips down, Mateta rushes in. What happens? Just tell us what happens, Pat. Just spell it back out because oh, it's painful in some ways, and yet you have to applaud it, don't you?
I think the chip was the right move. I kind of thought at first maybe he could have fired it a touch earlier at full power, but I think I'm being a little too rough and revisionist on him. Just great play by Robertson to come back and steal that away. He had another Mateta performance where he's the most enigmatic footballer we've ever been around. He did so many things great. And then he just did so many things bad, and it's just amazing. Now, granted, Konate and Virgil van Dijk are two giant, strong, incredible central defenders that have embarrassed and put away many, many, many great strikers. But Mateta was 3 for 16 in his duels, which is not good. Again, caveat that you're going against two world-class guys. I get it. But 3 for 16 for a striker, especially when we're trying to alleviate some pressure and in the second half when they're just pushing and pushing and pushing, and we needed that outlet. He wasn't just there. But that being said, he is a half, not even a half, a tenth of a step slower by Andrew Robertson and a fraction of a second slower by Allison's hand away from getting a brace. So the guy, he gives everything, so I can look past all the other stuff that he does. Is he going to give away the ball a couple times? Is he going to lose some duels here and there? Sure, but at the end of the day, he is so passionate. You can tell he gives everything for that shirt. He comes off knackered whenever he's tired and gets subbed off. I had some opinions of him that were a little negative, and I think they were due. I don't think that I was wrong. I think at the time he was playing a little poorly. But I am very happy to give him his flowers when he's due, and he's due them right now. He's been playing great. He's been working his tail off, and he's definitely one of the reasons for this system of Glasner's working the way it is.
For me, I always see him. I'm going to put it in an American way for you. Sorry. I see him like a dollar store Isak. I think they're very similar players. I think obviously Isak is more, let's say, clinical. I think that's a bit of an understatement there. Isak is obviously a phenomenal footballer, but for me, they're incredibly similar. They're incredibly tall. They use their physicality to their advantage brilliantly. It's such a huge part of their game. And yet they always seem to have a certain agility about them that almost defies belief. I just think Mateta is far less complete and competent in most departments, but he's essentially the same type of footballer. And with a bit more confidence, a bit more sharpness, he could say he's not far off that. He could be someone that could really lead this line for the future. And, there's already talks that he's, I mean, I made the joke about him playing for a contract. Obviously, he's been phenomenal outside of that. It's not the point, But he nonetheless, there is talks of a new contract for Mateta, and why not? We need to sort of lock down our key assets. And if he's someone that is less saleable and less likely to leave, then strategically, it makes sense to really build around him as one of those core players. I mean, he seems to get better with every game that he's starting. And I think this is probably the best we've ever seen in a Palace shirt from Mateta. I think that's pretty much a non-starter. There's no debate there, Of course, I wanted to park this for a bit, but I think we have to give kind of the best to last, really. And I feel bad for Eliseu Muñoz, who also had excellent games, but even the substitutes could be worth talking about. But we have to talk about Dean Henderson, boy, I've got you, Pat, because again, it's something that we've talked about so much on this pod. There's a lot of this sort of, I don't know if it's chauvinism, if you want to call it that, but this kind of come outside Henderson haters, all this kind of tribalism that we're seeing across the board. We have two very good goalkeepers. And we saw the best of our other goalkeeper at Anfield. It's that simple. I mean, five key saves there, Two clearances, a run out, punch, and of course a first clean sheet. And what a way to keep it in what felt like a near impossible situation with the amount of astounding saves he had to make. I mean, just talk to me about that Dean Henderson performance a little bit more.
Yeah, you can't really say much more about it. It was phenomenal. And let's make sure we're understanding how pivotal and how big of a deal it is to get a clean sheet at Anfield. In league this year, only Manchester United have gone up there and held Liverpool to a clean sheet, and that was a nil-nil draw. So we're the only team to go up there and keep a clean sheet and come back with 3 points all season. I mean, that's huge. He had those five saves, and the one thing that really doesn't, you can't quantify is how you're setting up that back line. We talked about Anderson being great as a leader in the middle of that back three as captain. He certainly was, but Henderson was constantly communicating, talking, making sure the players were shifting and doing what they needed to do to make sure that all ends were covered. No one was left open. No one was left unmarked. No one switched off defensively. All those things you're not going to be really able to quantify and put it onto a, pen and paper and look at the numbers of it. But you have eyes and watch the game. You can certainly see that he was doing that as well. So everything about it. And we know, one thing we know is that in general, it is so hard to statistically look at goalkeeping because it is such a mental position. Confidence is huge, huge, huge when it comes to goalkeeper. And I think just he needed a run of games to get his confidence back, not only physically get his legs back under him, but just get used to firing mentally out there. It's important. And now that he's been getting that run of matches, he's starting to play the way that we remember him playing when he wasn't playing for Palace, when he was doing some great things on some other squads. So I have no reason to believe that he's on a purple patch and he's just going to fade back to the mean. I think he's starting to rise back up to where he should be.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the meaningful improvement is ultimately the most exciting thing here. We talk about so many high potential players in this squad. You think about Adam Wharton, you think about Michael Olyse, Eze, so on. But we don't talk about Henderson. And, I know he's a little bit older, he's a completely different position. He's, really, really coming back from injury. I think he's finally finding some confidence in the knowledge that he's got a bit of run of games as well. And, there's talk about, him maybe trying to knock back onto the England squad. There's so many positives that are coming out after that game. And that will do him a world of good confidence-wise. So I'm really, really excited to see where Henderson goes from here. Really, really can't knock him. I think, we should probably stop put the debate aside, as we've already established, he's our keeper for the rest of the season. Beyond that, who knows, but probably. I will wrap it up about Liverpool there because I know it's not the best of circumstances for you right now. And I think it's better to be succinct here. What I will say to throw back to the City game a little bit is it feels like those two performances were both quite worthy. It's simply the fact that City felt more clinical. I mean, would you go along with that? And what was the data kind of saying on that, if you can remember?
Yeah, 100%. You hit the nail on the head there. City had a player by the name of Kevin De Bruyne who exceeded all metrics because he is just unbelievable. If that guy could stay healthy, he would be winning Ballon d'Ors constantly, but he just is always hurt. And thank God for Palace that he's hurt when he is not playing against us. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case when we played against him last week or 2 weeks ago, whatever you want to call it. But looking at the XG, we were pretty even with them. It was, they had a little bit more than us, but it wasn't 4-2 or anything like that. We played them well. We played them tight. We still showed a little bit of that aggression that you're seeing under Glasner. And yeah, it's kind of two ends of the same coin. And that's why this sport is what it is. It's such an amazing and incredible sport because things can change on a fraction of a thing. Like we talked about with Mateta, he scores that goal. We go up 2-0, and who knows? We might not be looking back. On the same token, Tyrick Mitchell doesn't come across out of nowhere and kick that solid chance out, in stoppage time, and we might be looking at 1-1. Henderson doesn't make a big save. We might be looking at losing 2-1 because of some individual greatness from Liverpool players. So City just happened to have that individual greatness and have some guys take over where Liverpool didn't, and we were able to see that match out. And in terms of how we're playing, you're starting to see the difference with Olise and Eze together. Those two are just, they're just, and they're incredible. We're so lucky to have them both at Palace. Olise is one of the most, if not the most talented player that I've personally watched since, and I've been watching since the promotion, so about 10, 11 years now. Probably the most natural ability of anyone I've seen wear a Palace shirt. And as a testament to that, for the match against Liverpool, when they both were on the pitch, when Eze and Elise were both on the pitch, Palace had 1.4 XG. They generated 1.4 XG to Liverpool's 1.2. So in the 68 minutes that Palace had both those guys on the pitch, we actually created more and conceded less against a team looking to win the title at Anfield, a very tough place to play. When they both came off, when we had neither of them on the pitch, we had 0 shots on total, not just on goal, 0 shots, which of course registered 0 XG, and Liverpool had 0.6 XG. When Eze was on the field by himself, they had another 0 point, or they had another 1 point something XG. So after Elise's exit, Liverpool had, I think, around 60% of their chances generated were after the 68th minute when Elise came off the field. Having him on the pitch, he didn't have his best performance yesterday. He was a little rusty, and that's understandable. It was his first start in a long time. But just his presence there on the pitch frees up Eze to get more opportunities on the ball, to get into space to create, which in turn frees up Mitchell to be able to create more on that side because it's that domino effect. So just having Elise there, even if he's not on his A game, is so pivotal for us. And the numbers back that up. I mean, we were creating, looking dangerous. And the second we came off, that was when we started to fade a little bit. And hey, it goes to show you, depth is super important. We don't have depth that great when we're healthy, let alone when we're kind of in a skeleton crew with all these injuries. So it's understandable that we dropped off that level when they came off, but I just wanted to highlight how important it is for both those guys to be on the pitch at the same time for us.
No, absolutely. They're two players that thrive off each other, and we've really been starved of seeing them together in a Palace shirt. So I'm really, really excited to see them back, and I just hope we can hold on to them for as long as possible. But realistically, I think that might not be the case from a financial standpoint. Speaking of finances, there will be a little part two, and I'll be looking at Palace's latest accounts, which did drop. This is not an accountancy podcast. I know it's as interesting as it sounds, but it's really worth addressing because I think when you get beyond the kind of the fine details, which are important, and I do suggest you go have a look as well if you get the chance. But there are some really, really good headline figures that I think are worth highlighting just to kind of allay some fan concerns as well. But just to end with you, Pat, Oliver Glasner picked up 5 points from his first six games as Frankfurt boss and then beat Bayern Munich at the Allianz. He did exactly the same thing as Palace boss, winning up five from his first six and then beating Liverpool Anfield. I mean, what this goes to show is I think there's a man who has methods, who has remarkable consistency on and off the pitch, on the training ground, and so on. And that consistency is building something, and we've always been seeing it building. That's the best bit. We talked about the data right at the start of this pod, and it's a nice loop back too, because I feel like that never went away. We're talking about two very different results between City and Liverpool here. I know we've not really done justice to City, and we won't, but which is a shame, I know. But both of those games had really strong positives. I think one of them just had good fruits for it. And I think there's a real process to trust here. Realistically, we look safer than we have in a long time. And I think, I don't want to eat my words, but I think we have to hold our hands up and say I think we're probably more nervous than we're due. I think to come away with that 3 points in the position that we are is a really, really strong platform. And I think for Oliver Glasner to have done that in such little time is a fine testament to his ability. So the future bodes well. And I think if there's a proof of concept here, we've got it now. We need to back it and see where it goes. But listen, in the interest of you not baking in that car and getting back to work, thank you for very much for coming on your lunch break. Have you got any closing thoughts? Any closing thoughts for the next games? Anything to say to the listeners?
Just to reiterate that the foundation has been there, and people that don't believe in the numbers and the data, I don't believe that. I don't believe you actually don't like the numbers and the data. I just think that you've been exposed to people that are not able to interpret it properly. I think that misusing data is so prevalent, and it leads people to not believe in the numbers. But I'm here to tell you that if you can look at what you need to look at and you can interpret it properly, that it's always going to be able to give you that trail and you're going to be able to draw these conclusions. I wasn't confident enough to say we were going to get a result at Anfield, but I was texting my friends and I was talking to people and I was saying, hey, just watch the way we play. We're going to surprise some people. I wouldn't be shocked if we had a great re if we had another great performance, but maybe it fell through at the end by some individual greatness. And that's just from reading all these things and looking at having it backed up by our eye test, because the eye test's showing it too. And Glasner talked about it in his post-match at Liverpool. He said that the results aren't the most important thing. It's the style of play. It's the foundations. It's the way we're playing, because eventually that is going to garner the results. If we do it backwards and we're just trying to win for the sake of winning, but we don't have that foundation, we don't have that style, then eventually it's going to become a house of cards and it's going to fall apart. But if we build this thing organically from the ground up, like we're supposed to do, then you're going to have some shock results here and there. You're going to have some disappointments, but ultimately you're going to have a lot more points than you would in any other way. So I'm a big believer in what he's doing, not because I have blind faith, but because I'm seeing it backed up by all these kind of metrics that I'm looking at and by how we're performing in the eye test. Both of those things are showing me that we have reason to be confident, and I'm really happy to see how this end of the season pans out. Just watch out for West Ham, because they're pretty much the opposite of Liverpool and Manchester City, where they're going to sit in their own box the entire match and look for space to counter on us. So it's going to be a very interesting clash where they're not going to give us space to counter, and we're probably not going to give them space to counter. It's going to be a very interesting one, just because it's the style of play that Moyes has. But I'm very excited for the rest of the season, and I'm very excited for next season as well under this new manager. And I think we all should be too.
Definitely. It's given us very much some cause for optimism. And I think that's something we've been absolutely robbed of this season as fans. We're not an entitled bunch. I don't think we ask for a lot. We just ask for a team that gives it their all. And we ask for, at least some kind of element of progress from a narrative standpoint. I think we're finally getting that. That's what makes us happy. That's a very light note to leave it on. But Pat, thank you very much for your time. Just before you go, can you plug your Twitter one more time?
Yeah, Tampa Palace. It's CPFC underscore Tampa, TAMPA. I try to do some match reviews. They're getting more and more regular. Sometimes I just didn't have time, but I've been doing the last few. And we're just, trying to look at tactics, trying to look at metrics, trying to look at data to explain why we're playing the way we are, or how we're playing, and what, things like that. So give it a follow if you're interested in that type of stuff. I got the match report on Liverpool. I go into a lot more detail on some things that we talked about on this pod. So, yeah, if you liked what you heard here, you'll probably really enjoy it. So check it out.
No worries, anytime. Right, we'll come over for part two now and we'll start to look at some delicious, delicious financial data. It's as sexy as it sounds, almost as sexy as a lovely, lovely team goal. Yep, let's pretend. Right, see you in the next part. We really do need a new jingle. Fun fact about that, and Bruno's going to hate me for saying this, but there is an origin story. We needed something short notice, and I think him and his girlfriend have some musical talent between them. I know he plays guitar and things like that. So yeah, we just he'd let them have a go at it, and they came back within about 15 minutes with that, a sort of glad all overtake, and never really looked back. It sort of has unexpectedly become a part of this pod. Oh well, weirder things have happened here, right? And speaking of weird, I think, one of the strange things about this season is the extent to which, committees, accountants and lawyers are just as much of interest to fans now as what's actually going on the pitch. Maybe a bit of an overstatement, but there is a point here in that, when you look at the likes of Forest and Everton, I think fans are genuinely more in tune now with what's going on outside and around their clubs as much as on the pitch. You cannot simply ignore the fact that there is a material impact on Palace's season from this, let alone for the clubs that are more directly affected. And, I think when we saw these accounts dropping the other day, I think, people were unbelievably excited in a way that we just haven't really seen football fans being excited for in a long time for something so banal that's normally just kind of left for the back pages for the nerds, But, it's vital. It's a degree of transparency. It's another way in which we can really sort of get an insight into the club that we know and love. And, I think behind what I'm trying to say here is that, money matters. Money talks in football. It's the reality of how the Premier League's grown. So with that being said, I think, partially because I was seeing people worried about, the threat of profit sustainability based on some of the loss figures we've seen. I thought it would be good just to go over just for literally a few minutes at the end in what is a very kind of, I'll admit, slapdash kind of second part, just to have a look at those numbers. I'm taking this, by the way, from a podcast that I personally know and love, Price of Football. I've mentioned it once or twice before. I think, the actual impact they've had on the game is understated, and I think, the influence in terms of those that are listening to it is phenomenal. If you don't know, it's a Palace and a Brighton fan. Kieran Maguire is the expert very much on the scene. Kevin Day, you might know him from 5 Year Plan. Again, two terrific hosts. They have great synergy, but most importantly, I think they really dig up the numbers, dig up the dirt, and give some fantastic insights. So I want to give full credit where it's due. I think it's only fair, it's only reasonable. But Kieran Maguire obviously took a look at the accounts and have some really, really interesting headline analysis. Just took a look at the key figures and so on. There's even one particular standout thing about a certain Steve Parish's wage that I think, caused a lot of controversy with the fan base. Now, unfortunately, as you probably heard earlier, it's just me, so I'm not going to debate, I'm not going to comment, but I thought I'd just take you through some of those numbers now. So looking at the accounts for CPFC 2010, which is the limited company for those that are interested, revenue grew by 12%, so it's up to 180 million. Wages also grew by 5%, so 130. On paper, that sounds quite good, but obviously the overall operating loss, not so good. A £20 million operating loss, which is no change actually from the last set of accounts. Nothing to worry about, and this is the one thing I really wanted to stress in this segment. I think I saw far too many people worrying about how that falls in relation to profit and sustainability rules and whether Palace are actually in trouble. We mentioned we're probably going to have to sell this summer in order to fund big spending. We simply haven't made a significant sale since the sale of Wan-Bissaka. If you want to look at Sørloth, you could probably throw him in there, but ultimately we've not really shifted any huge fee players. Speaking of, player purchases cost us 56 million in this accounting period, and player sales only yielded 300 grand. The accounting period ends on the 30th of June 2023, by the way, so please keep that in mind. There's going to be an obvious cut-off there. Kieran also made a really good point in that, for those that are probably wondering why revenues are up despite the lack of player sales, it's all related to the Premier League broadcast package deal. Essentially, revenue went up from international broadcasters. That's just a higher rate, that's a kind of a natural increase. And then some of you may remember, a bit of a throwback, in the glorious days of COVID, broadcasters were due a rebate because obviously the Premier League was unable to fulfill its fixtures and there was a sort of slight legal entanglement there. Obviously, share of revenue had to be paid back and that rebate is now ended. So that's obviously going to have an impact on TV revenue as well, which of course is far and away the main source of revenue for Palace. And it's also worth just saying that, going forward to next season, I think if there's one thing I will say, first and foremost, don't worry about financial fair play, we're fine. I think a £20 million operating loss is absolutely within the limits, and I don't think it's something to worry about. But I will say it's probably about time that we start to raise capital. I think we spoke on a previous episode recently about the bridging loan that we took out as further evidence that we're going to be funding this kind of rebuild that could be coming under Oliver Glasner with significant sales. I would very much expect your Gueye's and Elise's to go. Maybe your Andersons or Edouard's who don't tie down either could be sold on at kind of a break even or a small profit as well. There's definite scope for some movement in there. And I'm really, really curious as to see what happens from a transfer standpoint. But generally, the financial health of the club is not anything that's too out of the ordinary. It's quite normal to be a loss-making entity in the Premier League, I will say that. And I think a lot of people who maybe, I'm not an expert. I'm really not. I'm never, ever going to pretend to be an expert. But I think I have almost like a kind of duty of care to not ignore this story. I just think it's simply so important now to the way the modern game's gone that I just wanted to take a few minutes to address it. But yeah, I really think there are exciting times to come, and I don't think that the operating loss is anything to worry about. We're still very much within the right limits, and I think comparatively we're a long way off being in trouble. And particularly, like I say, if player sales do come, we're absolutely golden. Just stay with it. It's a bit of a ride, both on and off the pitch. I think that's the nature of football at the moment, and I think we'll get through the turbulence together. I always try and end on an optimistic note, and I think if there's one thing that this Liverpool game's done, it's just invigorated us again. I think Oliver Glasner, as I've said, has delivered proof of concept now, and I think it's really time to see whether the board will back him to the hilt. I think the fans will. I think if there's a game that's won us over as fans, it's that. I think, people would run through walls for him. Even just the team effort, even just the players huddling at the start, it's the little things. There's a sense of togetherness around the club that we were starved of, and I've used that word so many times today, but I am going to say it. We've been starved of so many good things, and I'm just incredibly excited for the next chapter. So there you go. Isn't that a lovely note? And on that bombshell, I'm going to wrap it up here. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much again to CPFC Tampa for coming on and giving his wonderful analysis. If you're not already doing so, make sure to follow our socials at The Palace Way, all across socials, and it's at The Palace Way on X. That's particularly where we post most. If you're not doing so already as well, make sure you check out thepalaceway.com. We're posting all sorts of high quality analysis across the women's game, the youth game, the men's game, and a lot more. And of course, if you do like this pod, please leave us a review. Even if you don't, all feedback's welcome. You can say whatever you want, one star, five star. It just helps us out. I would really, really appreciate it if you could just do that. We really want to try and make this as the best experience we can for you guys. We're doing it with a very limited budget. We're doing it with what we have. But we're just really proud to have been consistent this season and to really deliver something that's getting good feedback. And we just want to get better and better for you guys. We couldn't do it without you. I really do mean that. So if you've not done so, please leave us a review. Please leave a star rating on wherever you listen to your podcast, because it does help us out for visibility. I'll stop rambling now. Thank you very much for listening. Take care and see you in the next one. Up the Palace.